Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. I have the pleasure today of chatting with returning guest, Professor Barry Eichengreen. Barry is the George C. Pardee and Helen N. Pardee Professor of Economics and Professor of Political Science at the University of California, Berkeley, and also the author of the book, Hall of Mirrors, The Great Depression, The Great Recession, and the Uses and Misuses of History. And Professor, your book talks a lot about Europe, and given the headlines we see now coming out of Europe, in particular Greece, it's a particularly timely topic. Talk with the listeners about exactly what's going on in Greece at this point, if they may not be familiar with the technical aspect.
I think everybody by now probably is a little bit familiar with what's going on in Greece, given the way it's been grabbing the headlines. What's remarkable is that Greece is really experiencing a Great Depression. National income has fallen by 25% from the peak around 2009-2010. The downturn is every bit as severe as in the United States in the 1930s, our Great Depression. So I think given how severe the crisis there has been, how people's incomes have fallen, how people's pensions have been cut, how 10% of the Greek population now has no access to health care, the fact that the Greek public is upset, that they threw out their political class in January and replaced them with some neophyte ex-radical student politicians isn't really a surprise. But what that means is that the Greek government has been erratic, it's been unpredictable, it has antagonized its European partners, and the result of that, as we've seen, has been an economic crisis, a banking crisis, as they have been forced to effectively shut down their banking system as people fear that their euros will be converted into drachmas, and a terrible crisis for Greece and for the Greek people.
So when we look at the banking system in particular, I think of a lot of our listeners who have IRAs, who have 401ks, they're working Americans trying to build a nest egg. When you see what happened in Cyprus a couple of years ago with banking failures, when you see what happened here in the United States back in 2007, 2008, now you see what's going on in Greece, it's really scary. Talk to the listeners about what causes these banking failures?
Well, what causes them is a loss of confidence in the banks, either justified or not. So it could be justified because the banks have made bad loans and they lack the resources to pay out the money that their customers deserve. Or the crisis can be unjustified if depositors panic. We're in that kind of It's a Wonderful Life situation where the bank doesn't have everybody's cash on hand because it's put that money to work in terms of making loans to businesses and so forth. In Greece, there has been an element of both. There are a lot of bad loans because the economy has been in deep recession now for 5 years. But it looks like the Greek banking system was still solvent until the beginning of the summer, when people really began to fear that their euros would be converted into drachmas and began to pull those euros out of the bank at a rate that the banks couldn't satisfy, at which point the government had to put its famous 60 euro a day limit on how much money you could withdraw. If your listeners were told that their dollars would be were likely to be converted in the bank, were likely to be converted into pesos tomorrow, they'd want to get those dollars out before that devaluation happened. And that was the fear that was created in the minds of Greek households by the breakdown of negotiations between the Greek government and its creditors, and what I think was irresponsible behavior on the part of that government.
Professor, when you look at the rest of Europe and some of the other countries, Italy, Spain, Ireland, Portugal, is Greece the proverbial canary in the coal mine? Are we going to see more of the same over the next several years in Europe?
I think the Greek situation is one of a kind, that we now know that Greece had very deep problems of tax compliance, getting people to pay taxes, of budgetary transparency, of actually telling the public honestly how much the government was spending. I think those problems are qualitatively different from problems in Italy and Spain and Portugal, where there is also an underground economy, but by no means as extensive and problematic as in Greece. Where the Greek situation could be the canary in the coal mine is that if Greece ends up leaving the euro, people will learn that the euro is not forever. It's not irrevocable. It's a reversible commitment. And the next time a bad thing happens in another country, everybody is going to start running for the exits and asking if Greece could leave and devalue its currency and inflate, why can't Portugal or Spain or Italy? So I think the euro system is going to be much more fragile and unstable after Greece than it was before.
And we are recording this interview just for our listeners' benefit about 9 or 10 days before it actually airs. Professor, when you talk about Greece maybe leaving the euro, going back to the drachma so they can print, doesn't history teach us that printing or papering over a debt problem is a temporary solution that typically has a bad ending as well?
I think it would have a bad ending for Greece. So Greece doesn't have an easy out from its current problem. It can stay in the euro and negotiate the best deal it can with its European partners, but it's not going to be able to maintain the current level of public spending in that scenario. It will be required to implement more cuts. If it abandons the euro and starts printing drachmas, the government will be able to give funny money to pensioners and suppliers and public employees. But as you say, Dennis, the result will be inflation, high inflation, all manner of economic and financial chaos, and I think that outcome will be even worse.
So, Professor, let me go back and talk a little bit about Federal Reserve policy here in the United States and compare it to European Central Bank policy. It seems that the Fed has engaged in a number of quantitative easing programs. Now the European Central Bank is engaging in their own version of that program. Aren't these central banks just taking a plan out of really Japan's playbook of several years ago, and that hasn't worked out too well?
Well, they are taking a page out of the Japanese playbook, but I think the Fed did it better than the Bank of Japan. The point of quantitative easing is to head off deflation. If prices start to fall, firms stop investing, they stop hiring, people stop spending, and you get into a very dangerous economic situation. Quantitative easing had a bunch of undesirable side effects. It did cut into the incomes of older people who rely on their savings in order to buy groceries. It did encourage investors to stretch for yield by moving into riskier investments. But On the other hand, it did head off that deflation, which is once you fall into that trap, it becomes very hard to escape. So the Japanese waited too long. Once they started easing, they found it hard to climb back out. The Fed moved to QE a bit earlier, and on balance, I think that helped.
Do you think that the Fed, moving ahead, Professor, will be engaging in additional QE programs?
I'm hopeful that economic recovery in the United States is now solid, and that it's not going to be thrown off track by events in Europe or a weakening Chinese economy. And if that's right, if economic recovery is solid, I think the Fed, which has now phased out quantitative easing, will move to normalize the level of interest rates beginning sometime late in the year. But it's clear that our central bankers are looking closely at how events abroad are affecting the American economy, and if they affect us negatively, the central bank might respond by delaying those interest rate increases, and in if things turn out for the worst, engaging in more securities purchases. I do not think that more securities purchases are likely, but everything depends on how economic growth in the U.S. develops.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Our guest today has been Barry Eichengreen. Barry is the George C. Pardee and Helen N. Pardee Professor of Economics and Professor of Political Science at the University of California, Berkeley. He's also the author of the book Hall of Mirrors, The Great Depression, The Great Recession, and the Uses and Misuses of History. Professor, thank you for joining us once again today. Enjoyed the conversation.
As did I. Thank you.
And special thanks to our guest expert today, Mr. Barry Eichengreen, for joining us. In a prior segment, I talked about the fact that we believe because human behavior is predictable, that economies tend to cycle. And these cycles occur over a very long period of time. In fact, they occur over such a long period of time and move so slowly that they're very difficult to recognize as cycles. However, in this prior segment, we talked about the fact that an autumn cycle exists when economic prosperity seems to be everywhere, when stock prices are up, when real estate prices are up, when jobs are plentiful. And yet, in spite of all this prosperity, amid all this prosperity, we see debt levels rising slowly to unsustainable levels. In fact, the prosperity that exists really exists as a result of rising debt levels. It's debt-fueled consumption. Once debt in the system reaches its capacity, the economic cycle or economic season changes to winter. And during winter, debt is purged from the system. So basically what we've been seeing over the past several years is debt being purged from the system. We can go all the way back to the financial crisis of 2007 and 2008, and we saw an extreme example of debt being purged from the system. Well, as a result of all this debt being purged from the system and wanting to avoid the ugly symptoms of debt purging, central banks around the world have created money. They've printed money through quantitative easing programs or whatever they may call them. When money is created, money finds a home, and as a result, in our view, asset bubbles exist. So right now around the world, what we see are a couple different symptoms. We see that we have the symptoms of too much debt. We have defaults on debt. We have banks shuttered in Greece. We talked about that in an earlier segment. We'll talk about some more of those symptoms in this segment, and we also see bubbles forming. Now, the bottom line is this. The eternal truth is that if there's too much debt to be paid, it won't all be paid. And I'll go back and use the example that I used in this prior segment. When the city of Detroit declared bankruptcy, one of the primary reasons given for Detroit's insolvency was the pension plans were underfunded. They were underfunded to the tune of about $3.5 billion. And as I said in a prior segment, I said at the time on the air that it really didn't matter if federal law or state law was more valid or which would be honored. The bottom line was that there was not enough money in the checkbook to pay everyone their promised benefits and that they wouldn't be paid all their benefits, and that's exactly what happened. Now we're seeing these symptoms of debt existing in other places. In fact, we talked about Greece. Well, Puerto Rico made the news about the same time as Greece. Puerto Rico announced that government efforts to slash expenditures and restructure debt have failed. Puerto Rico's governor simply stated the debt is not payable. Now, according to Morningstar, 80% of Puerto Rican debt is in muni bond funds. Mutual funds that specialize in muni bonds own 80% of Puerto Rican debt. And 180 United States mutual funds have at least 5% of their portfolios in Puerto Rican bonds. Now, as many of you know, as the likelihood of getting repaid goes down, interest rates go up. Creditors become more skeptical of the ability of the borrower to pay them back. Well, the price of the most actively traded Puerto Rican general obligation municipal bond, it pays 8% interest. It's an 8% coupon rate. It's due July 1 of 2035. It's now trading at 68% of par, 68% of the issue price or maturity date. What does that mean? That means that investors think Puerto Rico is not going to be able to meet their obligations. On Tuesday, the Puerto Rican governor said that the island will try to delay payments on its $72 billion debt load for a number of years. Bloomberg reports that Puerto Rico's securities have different repayment pledges. And what that means is investors may now be pitted against each other to see who gets any money that still might be available. Now, central bankers have taken a look at Greece. They've taken a look at the credit issues, the credit crisis in the United States, and they have gone to the printing press. Well, when money is created, money finds a home and it creates bubbles. In fact, the New York Times had an interesting article on this titled "Loads of Debt, a Global Ailment with Few Cures." I'll give you just a bit from the article. This was published on June 29, 2015. There are some problems that not even $10 trillion can solve. That gargantuan sum of money is what central banks around the world have spent in recent years as they've tried to stimulate their economies and fight financial crises. The tidal wave of cheap money has played a huge role in generating growth in many countries, cutting unemployment, and preventing panic. But it's not been able to do away with days like Monday, when fear again coursed through global financial markets. The main causes of the steep declines in stock and bond markets were announcements out of Greece and Puerto Rico, and we've discussed those. And in China, the declines in its stock market were also a sobering reminder that stubborn problems lurked in the global economy. The New York Times article quotes Puerto Rico's governor, who again said that debts are not payable. And the article points out that debt, extreme debt, is also bogging down the economies of Brazil, Turkey, Italy, and China. And they also point out that central banks and their worrying printing presses can do only so much to alleviate the burden. Monetary policy can help mask the symptoms of debt, but cannot be a cure, said Diana Choileva, who's chief economist at Lombard Street Research. So let's take a look at where some bubbles may be forming as a result of this printing of money. Well, in Australia, household debt to home values Household debt to home values are rising significantly. In fact, household debt as a percentage of income was 155% in the first quarter of 2015, its highest level ever, and that is actually a lower ratio than in Canada, where it's 166%. So I would predict that we will see real estate markets in both Australia and in Canada behave a lot like the U.S. real estate market did a few years ago, and arguably the U.S. real estate market may also be in another mini bubble, in our opinion, due to, again, in our opinion, Federal Reserve policy. Now, where will the next default occur? We've talked about Greece today. We've talked about Puerto Rico. Well, the New York Times article points out that there is a standoff taking place over debt in the Ukraine. Ukraine is moving closer to default after creditors continued lending to the country despite zero growth and a corrupt political system. Now some of these creditors, including Franklin Templeton, an American investment firm, have resisted Ukraine's demand. They take a loss on their principal investment. Instead, the company said they will extend the repayment period. So look at the next potential debt standoff to be in the Ukraine, especially since Ukraine's finance minister, Natalie Jaresko, said last week that a default was theoretically possible. Bottom line is this: if there's too much debt to be paid, it won't be paid, and that's the situation, in our opinion, in which we find ourselves. That will mean that the way traditional investments perform, in our opinion, will change and likely change dramatically. We look at all this in our Investor's Discovery Kit. If you've not yet gotten your complimentary copy, I would invite you to visit the website, investingapproach.com. The website, again, is investingapproach.com. All you have to do to get your free Investor's Discovery Kit is enter your name and address. Let us know where to mail it. We'll be glad to get it out to you. That concludes our second podcast of the week. Hope you got something you can use. Bye.